Good morning. Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. This is cold turkey day. I don't have not had an espresso. So they had to check the pilots before these things begin, you know, to make sure they're all set to go. We're going to be talking about some of the headlines today. There is the beginning of bargaining between the big three, well, not the big three, General Motors and Unifor. And it is, there's a front page story in the Globe. I urge you all to hunt it up because the big issues that all Canadians should be concerned about involve such things as, you know, are we going to ever have electric vehicles and are we going to have an auto industry? Later in the show, we're going to be talking about also the atomic, this issue of nuclear weapons, because, of course, we're just only yesterday, I believe it was, we were marking once again the anniversary of the bombing of Nagasaki. There is also a new development in the West Asia / Middle East, that is at Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey have some type of thing they call a defense agreement. And I want to share with you some notes I have from a conversation, email conversation with Zafar Bengash, who unfortunately won't be able to make it, but I can convey what Zafar's news is. So we'll be doing all those things later on. I believe we're joined by Tony Lee. Are you there, Tony?
Hi, Phil. I am.
Tony, by the way, is the author of The Truth about the 37 Oshawa GM strike. They made cars and they made plans. Reds, the rank and file, and international solidarity unionized General Motors. Oh, General Motors. And so here we are, Tony. Today's news is that there's the beginning of the negotiations with GM, and you were a GM worker and are a retiree. And I noticed that the headline is, the summary of the issues starts with the issue of the matter of job security and guarantee of a plant that is closed currently, the guarantee that it's going to reopen. Tell me if I got that right, and also where we are. I know this is one of the big three. Unifor has already done a deal with or come to an agreement with Ford. So speak to those things, if you would.
Sure, Phil. That basically, in a nutshell, is one of the key issues in bargaining between Unifor and the auto companies this year, bargaining a new three-year contract, is security of the jobs of the workers. And I think that everybody recognizes that there's been a steady deterioration of jobs in the auto industry and auto assembly in Canada. When I was on the bargaining committee with General Motors in 1996, I think GM had 8 plants operating in Canada that we represented. Ford had several plants. Chrysler at the time had several plants. And we're now down to only 2 plants for GM in Canada that produce vehicles. One has been shut, and GM says that it's permanently shut. That's the plant in Ingersoll that's known as CAMI. And the Oshawa plant, which had 1/3 of its workers laid off earlier this year from 3 shifts down to 2 shifts. And that's it. And it's similar situation at Ford and Stellantis, which took over from Chrysler. Ford has 1 vehicle assembly plant left in Oakville and an engine plant in Windsor. Stellantis has a vehicle assembly plant in Windsor, but their other major plant in Brampton has been shut for a couple of years now. And the vehicle that Stellantis was planning on putting in that plant was then moved to Ohio because of the political and economic situation with the Trump government. So everything is shaky. And of course, that's a major topic on the minds of workers at General Motors. The problem is,
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, the problem is that the union says that they're going to bargain job security, but their framework for doing that leaves things very precarious for workers in Canada. People may not know that over 90% of the vehicles assembled in Canada are exported to the United States. And Canada has a large vehicle sales market, you know, one of the top five in the world, I think, almost 2 million vehicles a year. But 90% of those vehicles that Canadians buy are imported to Canada, some from the U.S., from Europe, from Japan and Korea. And the companies that produce vehicles in Canada are all foreign companies. GM and Ford are American companies. Stellantis is a European company. Honda and Toyota produce vehicles in Canada and in Ontario, and they're Japanese companies. So we have allowed a situation to develop where we're completely dependent in the industry on foreign companies that are producing vehicles for export to the United States. And that's inherently unstable. And that is why we're in a crisis right now, because as soon as Donald Trump says there's going to be tariffs on Canadian vehicles, those companies don't want to produce vehicles in Canada anymore. And what we really need in a broader perspective is an industry that produces vehicles in Canada for Canadians.
And what are the prospects of that?
Well, it would take a real commitment from different levels of government in Canada, and it would certainly take our union pushing for that, as putting pressure on governments to make that part of their objective and not just...
By the way, if I could just say, right, these things float into my mind, is that we often talk about electric vehicles, we often talk about China. You didn't mention China is, that hasn't quite got underway here. That's my impression. But
I think the first few vehicles that are now allowed without the 100% tariff have started arriving in Canada.
Yeah, they are arriving. But on this, it seems to speak kind of nicely to your point in that the Trump, of course, despises China, and he and everybody in his administration and the previous Biden administration say they're going to make sure that they control China. So they wouldn't, they, if there are any Chinese vehicles here, they're not going to go to the U.S. Now, the beauty of it might be that you could get a Chinese company, and obviously they would be only making them for the Canadian market because the Trump wouldn't allow them, right?
And at the moment, that's absolutely true. But
that would almost solve our problem.
This is a huge market, which is, you know, been almost completely ignored, which is of building vehicles in Canada for Canadians. I'm sure there would be a huge market for an affordable electric vehicle for Canadians to purchase made in Canada if there was one.
Yeah.
And it would certainly be enough to support a plant or more than a plant.
By the way, speaking of huge, why do we make so many huge vehicles, which cost so much?
Because they're more profitable. And this is also part of the problem, that we are beholden to corporations owned by billionaires from other countries, and they don't really care about Canada, Canadian communities, Canadian workers. They only want to make the maximum profit. And right now in North America, the maximum profit comes from monstrous pickup trucks and monstrous SUVs. For pickup trucks, the profit per vehicle is something like $20,000. It's just massive. And of course, they're rolling off the assembly line you know, one a minute or something like that.
Going off to the U.S.
And going off to the U.S. because yes. that's where the profits are. And as soon as you tell GM, well, you might not be able to, you might have to pay a tariff, or people might have to pay a tariff if you send a vehicle to the United States, then they say, oh, wow, we're shutting our plant in Ingersoll because we're not going to make that profit anymore. And that's what they did. And that's what Stellantis did in Brampton. They said, yeah.
"Well,
they're going to hit us with tariffs, so we're not going to produce the vehicles in the Jeep Compass in Brampton anymore. We're going to produce it in Ohio."
Mm-hmm. To be bought here if somebody wants one.
If somebody wants one, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. We're speaking to Tony Lea, but I always remind you that Braca Books published Tony's book, The Truth About the 37 Oshawa GM Strike. You can read it as a, you know, kind of an advisory on how labor needs to look after itself. And Tony, today's Globe quotes several people, including you, actually, about this matter of subject of leverage, how companies hold off on the subject of whether or not they're going to reinvest as a form of bargaining. And then, and it is said there that the key issue for Unifor is that they want to guarantee that these plants are going to be reopened. But that's an echo from, I recall, previous negotiations where that was exactly the subject. And then they came away and said, all right, we've got a contract and we've got a promise, not quite a guarantee. But it did, then they said, well, no, we've hit hard times, so we're not going to do that. I mean,
how
good are these? Suppose they said, all right, Unifor, we agree with you. Here it is. So we did. GM on the bottom line here. We're going to reopen. But can't they just stick? Well, isn't it a practice that over the years that they don't live up to these promises?
They break almost every promise or so-called promise that they make. And I said a little bit more to the Globe and Mail reporter than actually made it into the story. And I certainly wasn't intending to attack the union or the union negotiators, but I think it's very important for everybody to recognize that in all of these agreements, when the companies say they're making a commitment for investment in Canada, there are always conditions on that. And if you read the conditions, it's dependent on the economy. It's dependent on
assuming
decisions.
It's kind of like a boss saying, well, if you know, assuming sales are as good as they were last year, you'll be here. And
it's,
you say, oh wow.
Yeah, it's dependent on a whole bunch of things, a whole long list, and you know, I could read them to you, but yeah. It would just dismay people. But the bottom line is that there is no penalty on the corporation if they change their mind on those commitments. Mm-hmm. And there's no guarantee that they will live up to them. And so it mm-hmm. becomes an issue where the union says, we feel we've negotiated something that will protect your jobs here or some of your jobs,
mm-hmm.
But they can't really guarantee it. And if the company says, well, conditions have changed, and this has happened numerous times with all of the companies that we bargain with, there's no recourse.
Mm-hmm. So, and if we go back to the other matter of historically what it is what is the leverage that the workers have, the unions, and that is the withdrawal of labor, right?
Yes.
I'm looking around. I don't see any other leverage. I don't, and ordinarily, when you go into these things, we hear about strike mandates and things like that in order to get everybody's attention. Is that a possibility in this current situation?
The contract the current collective agreement with General Motors expires on September 20th. And traditionally, bargaining by the union in Canada has started with a vote for a strike mandate and the setting of a strike deadline. Mm-hmm. And then workers then do have that leverage that if they don't get, if the bargaining committee doesn't feel that they've got a good agreement, they can lead workers out on strike. But this year, Unifor announced that they were going to bargain early with Ford, and they bargained without a strike mandate because the contract was not coming up for expiry. So they set a target date for an agreement, but they had no response if they didn't have the agreement by that target date other than to continue talking. And they ended up going about a day past the target date before they got an agreement that they took to the workers at Ford to ratify. And so far at GM, they're following basically the same game plan. There has not been a strike vote by GM workers, even though we're only about 5 weeks or so away from the contract expiring.
It's interesting,
so they're bargaining without that.
The tradition always, actually, it's like it's the language of the, and reportage has changed. It was always the strike date, or the strike, pardon me, mandate was always, I don't want to say it was done for propaganda purposes, but that certainly had that effect in that it had to be reported, right?
It was reported and it showed.
Media would say, whoa, well, the contract is up and they have a strike mandate. So you out there, Joe Citizen, have to know this.
It was traditionally strong. It was 90% or 95% or more of the workers said, we're prepared to go on strike if necessary. And of course, that would be reported and that would show that the union, the bargaining committee, had the backing of workers.
Curious situation. I guess we'll call it modernization in order not to hurt anybody's feelings. but you have a concern as a GM retiree. There is a question of the pensions. You know, we have a lot of inflation, you probably noticed. And so how much, where does the issue of pensions come into these talks?
Retirees in the auto industry have been noticing inflation because it is just destroying their standard of living. For retirees from the three major auto companies in Canada, there have been no increases in pensions since 2007.
2007? Gee, that's...
So people who retired then or before then are getting the same pension that they did in 2007, and inflation has been about 51% over that period of time. So they've lost half of the purchasing power of their pensions.
Half.
And at GM, by the way, that's almost 25,000 people that retired under that pension plan. And because it's a closed plan, the union agreed that nobody hired after 2016 would be part of that pension plan. People are dying off, frankly, and the number of retirees in that plan are being reduced. And there's developed an absolutely massive surplus. In the case of the GM plan, $1.5 billion of surplus is in that plan, which is supposed to be for the benefit of the retirees. And yet, there has not been an increase in pensions other than a pittance. And what was agreed at Ford was to increase the amount that these retirees from before 2016, the amount that they would get was increased by $50 per quarter or $200 per year.
Whoa. Hey.
Not built into the...
That would cover two dinners out, I think.
Something, yeah, maybe.
Maybe. No, I wouldn't include tip with it.
And that amount it's a lump sum. It doesn't increase the monthly pension. So at the end of the contract, they're still getting the pension that was there in 2007. So if that's what we get it at GM, and of course, Unifor always says they bargain a pattern agreement, and they expect the other companies to match it. That will leave that $1.5 billion surplus in the pension plan and not benefiting the 25,000 retirees at GM, average age 78. You know, who may not be here a whole lot longer and could really benefit from a much larger payment. And there's the money is in the plan to provide a larger.
It's $1.5 billion in the plan.
Yes.
And
that's a surplus. There's
it's in the name of the pension.
Yes.
And but the people who are to receive can't get it until they crawl through a narrow pipe having something to do with bargaining.
Yes.
And they didn't, and they came out with $50 a quarter, I guess.
At four, that's what
or
they got
basically it. A quarter. Wow.
Yes.
It's very sobering. I hope the 25,000 are you know, will find their voice because it sounds, it's not crooked, but it sure is not nice.
Many of the retirees.
I thought these companies were really, you know, community people and cared about the society in which they find themselves, and they would look over and say, oh, we have 1.5 billion here that really actually should be shared out about amongst you guys. And that doesn't happen. The banks make money over money that's just sitting there. That's part of what they are in charge of.
They are, I'm sure, trying to figure out how they can get their hands on that money.
Oh, I have a question. You have any idea whether the management people at the big three, if their pensions are okay, do they get increases and that kind of thing? Could you hazard a guess? I know that we're not allowed to know.
Yeah, the lower level management had their pensions frozen quite a number of years ago, so they're not getting increases either. But the upper level of management, the CEOs and so on, a number of years ago switched their model of compensation so that they don't get a pension when they retire. They get stock. So they build up stock or stock options that they're able to exercise once they leave, which is worth tens of millions of dollars probably. In some cases.
So the revolutionary group might be the middle managers who got frozen.
They're
probably the most dangerous people in the business.
A lot of them are not happy.
They're not being invited to the golf club.
But the upper level, they don't care about pensions at all because they now get stock and stock options, and it's very, very lucrative. The CEO of General Motors, Mary Barra, made close to $50 million last year in addition to...
In a year.
In addition to the stock options that are going to be available to her when she retires.
Well, at least somebody's not going to be harmed if the economy is shaken up. This is Tony... We're speaking to Tony Leo, author of The Truth About the 37 GM Strike. And actually, this news of the bargaining came up, and we wanted to talk about that. But there's another matter we want to get to, which is that the Unifor Canadian Council is meeting on August 28th. That's every local, if I understand, is represented. And there's going to be a resolution concerning, I guess the label is hot cargo, having to do with Israel-Palestine. What is that about, if you could tell us?
Yes, a few locals of Unifor have sent in this resolution, which has been promoted by Labor for Palestine, a really remarkable group of people in the labor movement that have been organizing support for Palestine over the last few years. And the resolution calls on Unifor, I'll read you the resolution, that Unifor National will endorse the call from Palestinian trade unions to to declare goods, trade, services, and relationships with Israel to be hot cargo, thereby permitting workers not to handle such goods, and further, to cut ties with the Histadrut, an arm of the Israeli state and quasi-labor body embedded in the occupation of Palestine. So that has been sent in by some Unifor locals, which means that it will be debated by the delegates at the Canadian Council meeting, and we're hoping that, it will be passed.
Well,
at the Unifor convention, a constitutional convention last year, a resolution was brought forward that called for an arms embargo, two-way arms embargo with Israel, and that resolution was passed. You know, so there has been growing support within the labor movement and within Unifor for taking stands like that.
This is more and more a trend we're seeing. By the way, on the Histadrut point, I think everyone was shocked and kind of woke up about what is going on when there was a photograph featured in Israeli media of the president or leader of Histadrut putting a message on a missile being fired into Gaza, or a bomb that was going to be dropped. And he endorsed it for his organization.
Yes.
That's, you know, there's somebody, should have been some kind of meeting, international labor and expulsion for that kind of conduct. I mean, that is so personally repulsive. I can understand politics and people might say, oh, I'm for the government or what, but to actually go to the trouble of making, you know, putting your name or the name of your group on a bomb, it's going to kill somebody. That's a bit much.
Kill many people, many civilians.
Yeah,
in fact, and
primarily and, civilians. By the way, of course, that's why the South Africa was able, has so far brought a very compelling case to the International Court of Justice. Actually, this is, people think this is just a mere political squabble. It's not at all, and it is dividing everybody. I mean, look at the United States. Political turmoil going on now. You have people running for Congress in the United States Senate who are making this the basis of their campaigns, and this is not because somebody thought of this idea. It's because of the ongoing horrible conditions of the people of Gaza, with nobody offering any solutions, and actually, except from Trump and Netanyahu, to make it worse. So they shouldn't be surprised. Let's follow this very closely. That's going to be August the 28th, right?
Yes, August 28th to 30th is the Canadian Council meeting. So at some point over those proceedings, there'll be a discussion on this resolution.
Yeah. You wouldn't be attending that, right?
No, I'm not. A few of my friends are and will be supporting the resolution.
And again, that's the, people want to know more about it. It's the Labor for Palestine. They have a site, right? People can go and see.
Yes,
they probably find the resolution.
They've been doing a lot of good work in a lot of unions, played a major role in making some progress at the last convention of the Canadian Labor Congress, which voted to disaffiliate or cut all ties with Histadrut. So there has been really...
That was a big story underreported, by the way.
Yes. It was reported beforehand, where the right-wing media portrayed it as, in the most lurid, disgusting terms, as support for terrorism or something. But then after it passed, then they shut up. It didn't report it at all.
Yes. That's always the best form of overcoming an opponent, is not to, is just deprive him of speech or attention. Or, you know, in other words, just completely, just since they can't win any debate, just make sure the other voice isn't heard. Well, Tony, the author of The Truth About the 37 Ottawa GM Strike, which you can get from Baraka Books, Tony Leah, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Phil.
Bye-bye. This is the Taylor Report, CIOT. I guess it seems appropriate to that old song, 16 Tons, which has to do with if you work for a living, you'll get the pleasure out of it.